Welcome to Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio. I'm on the phone with Guy McPherson, who is one of those, a rarity in many ways, and you're going to find this out as this interview progresses. But this is somebody who has not only gotten familiar with the science, but has written some of the science, knows the science, has written books about the science of global climate change, has the knowledge about peak oil, has the knowledge about where things are going with our environment and with climate, well, let's just say climate catastrophe. And he is at the forefront not only of talking about it, but he's actually dropped out of academia to get a farm started and be ready for the collapse that he and so many have been talking about. So, Guy McPherson, Dr. McPherson, good to be talking to you here on Shift Shapers. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Daniel. I greatly appreciate it.
One of the things that is, first of all, you have a list of books that you have written. It's on your website. I'm going to give everybody the name of your website right off the bat. It's Nature Bats Last. It's Guy McPherson's blog. And one of the pages on this site is a listing of the books that you have written, and it looks as though you've got, I'm seeing maybe at least a half a dozen, I'm scrolling through about 10 books here, and it seems as though as I scroll through, I'm going from 2004, actually before that, early in the decade of the 2000s, and as we start scrolling down into the more recent and more recent of the books, you're seeing a more dire situation. Now, I'm wondering, can you share with us a little bit about your progression as a thinker on this subject and as an academician teaching at a university in Arizona? How did this all develop for you?
Well, shortly after I arrived at the University of Arizona, May of 1989, at the age of 29, that was my first tenure track position. Shortly after I arrived there, I started studying global climate change, and it was pretty apparent even then that if we didn't make some pretty drastic changes in our lifestyles, in our entire society, that we were headed for near-term human extinction. I was a conservation biologist, and so I studied what we do to other species as well. And so currently we're driving some 150 to 200 species a day to extinction. You put those together, and all that spells bad news for the human experience. In 2003, I was writing a book for the general populace called Killing the Natives, Has the American Dream Become a Nightmare? And I came across the notion of world peak oil. And as an ecologist, I was well educated in the notion of limits to growth, including growth of societies. And so the notion that declining oil extraction and delivery would lead to collapse of the industrial society. That was no big shock. That was no big surprise. So it made me realize that, hey, there might be a Hail Mary pass. There might be a way out of human extinction in the near term if we can just complete the collapse of the industrial economy in a relatively short period of time. Then we might be able to save our species, whether it's worth saving or not, as well as that 150 to 200 species a day we're driving to extinction.
You know, that's unique about your approach is, like, I've talked to people like James Howard Kunstler and Richard Heinberg, and the main thrust of the conversation, what they're putting in their books, has to do with the end of civilization. Like, this is a dark time we're headed for as we have used up the fuel and this material that we use for everything, this petroleum. But you're saying that, oh, no. We're talking about human extinction on the biological level. And it's good if civilization totally stops, because that will stop the addition of more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Don't worry about that. Peak oil, good. And like in the big picture on human habitat, that issue, actually, you're saying that's what has to happen.
Absolutely. If we don't terminate this absurd and abnormal set of living arrangements known as civilization within a very near future, we're not talking about the end of civilization. We're talking about the end of our species, as well as a whole bunch of other species we drive over the abyss every single day. So I'm a little irritated, actually, at scientists and pundits who keep talking about the end of civilization as if it's a bad thing. Industrial civilization is the bad thing. the end of that is a good thing. Will there be consequences for humans, especially industrialized humans or humans in industrialized nations? Of course. I suspect there will be tremendous human suffering ahead. On the other hand, I know there is tremendous human suffering going on right now, and there has been for a long time. Drone program, anybody? I mean, we're bringing this tremendous amount of suffering around the globe, and what has people worried is that we might suffer ourselves. Our privileged industrialized selves might actually have some of that suffering brought to us. Yeah, maybe so. But let's think about contemporary consequences for a change.
And we're doing some extraordinary measures. When you talk about when doctors talk about a patient who is, they're trying to keep them alive, even though they're really about an inch away from brain death, that it's called extraordinary measures when you start doing all sorts of very advanced things to keep the body alive. And when I talk about extreme measures in this keeping civilization going, I'm thinking about the tar sands. I'm thinking about squeezing oil out of dirt to try to make oil out of it, busting out rocks so that you can get more, and causing actually earthquakes in order to get more natural gas, and then going out into the Middle East and other places to occupy countries and blow them up so that we can take their petroleum and do anything we can to keep this thing going, where NATO has our back on the whole thing. I mean, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yes. I mean, there's a reason we're extracting oil from places it's absolutely absurd to extract it from, like deep water in the ocean, like the tar sands. It isn't even oil, really. It's a tremendous energy expensive mining operation to get that petroleum product out of the ground and refined into some form that we can use in our cars. We've been occupying other nations for a long time for their oil. In fact, I think the last decent man in the Oval Office was a guy named Jimmy Carter. He's known for the Carter Doctrine. The Carter Doctrine says that with respect to the Middle East, that's our oil over there. So we've been doing this for a while, this oppression abroad approach to maintaining American empire. But we know where empires go, don't we?
There have been a number of them.
Quite a few of them have died in Afghanistan, in fact.
Yes, isn't that ironic? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost like there's a vortex there of some sort. Hmm. Now, when you're talking about, one of the things that's really richly outlined on your blog, and it's called Nature Bats Last. Now, for those of you just tuned in, I am talking to Guy McPherson, who is a professor emeritus from the University of Arizona, who left, and we're going to get to that pretty soon. He left a tenured career as a professor talking about and teaching students about environmental issues, and we're going to get into what you left that for, but I do want to just, for one thing, really establish and nail for our listeners just how dire is this circumstance with the environment. What is it that you see? We've got this human habitat. What's happening to it?
It's pretty easy for me to imagine three near-term routes to human extinction. I'm sure there are more, but we're working really hard on these three. The first of those is environmental destruction or environmental decay. As we drive 150 to 200 species to extinction every day, that's not good. If we have a year without bees, and North America in particular is in colony collapse disorder, we have a year without bees, the next year we don't have humans because that's what pollinates our food is the bees. We're eroding the world's soil into the world's oceans at an astonishing rate. We're fouling our air. We're dirtying our water. Industrial civilization does all of this with stunning aplomb. I mean, we are amazingly efficient at destroying every aspect of the living planet. We need the living planet to survive. We don't need oil to survive. We need a living planet to survive. But we're working as hard as we can to destroy that, it seems to me. The second route to near-term human extinction is climate change. And the numbers just keep getting worse and worse and worse. November of last year, International Energy Agency concluded that we were headed for a 6°C warmer planet by 2035.
That's
by 2035. That's 23 years from now, if I'm doing the math right, a little less. And 6°C means there's no phytoplankton in the ocean. That's the base of the whole food chain. They produce 50% of the oxygen for the planet. The ocean has become so acidified that there is nothing essentially alive there except a couple of jellyfish and maybe a handful of other species. 6°C means sea level rise of around 250 feet. It means, well, last time it was 6°C warmer on this planet, there were snakes the size of yellow school buses living in the Amazon, and the largest mammal on the planet was the size of a shrew, because that's the largest mammal that can thermoregulate at that kind of temperature. And we're just pushing that forward. I mean, 2008, the year of the Great Recession, when we stopped calling depressions because that was too depressing, the year of the Great Recession, carbon emissions reached their highest level since we fully implemented the Clean Air Act.
And that was in a recession.
Yeah. I would say we've been in an economic depression since 2008. And in that time, we set a record in 2008. We shattered the record in 2009 when we increased carbon emissions by 6% over the previous year. Then we ratcheted that up in 2010, increased it by 6.5%. It looked like we're in the exponential phase. Last year, we only increased carbon emissions by 3.2%. But still, that's 3.2% over the previous year, which is a record over the previous year, which is a record over the previous. You see where this is going.
I'd like to put this into a little bit of perspective, too, because thank you for that, Guy McPherson, for what this loop is starting to look like. This movie came out called The 11th Hour a few years ago, and people just were, a lot of people were offended by it. They said, how come you could have so many dire things in a movie and not let us walk out of the theater with hope? He had about 3 minutes of hope at the end, and the rest of it was all about what the situation is. And you wrote a blog, and what the mainstream media, very often it's like, global warming, great. It means palm trees in the Arctic. It means everything's going to be lovely. It's going to be beautiful, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be really very nice things. It won't be quite so cold. You're not subscribing to that. You're talking about some systems that we require for our survival being drastically changed with this rising temperature.
Yes. 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 Absolutely. And I hear over and over and over again how we have to have electricity, we have to have Wi-Fi, we have to have gas for our cars, and on and on and on. In other words, we have to maintain industrial civilization. Industrial civilization has been around for, 150 years or so? Civilization in its broadest form has been around for a few thousand years. We spent the first 2 million years of the human experience without anything resembling civilization, without electricity. We got along just fine. There were fewer of us, for sure. We didn't live as long. But by every measure, it wasn't a bad experience for human beings to be human animals living in the world. Hmm. The hope amongst most people I know, which means people who are deeply engaged in industrial civilization, the hope that we can maintain the system by changing our light bulbs and taking shorter showers is ridiculous. It doesn't work that way. It can't work that way. If we're going to maintain habitat for human beings on this planet, we're going to have to do something really, really dire. There was a paper came out 2.5 years ago in the prestigious journal Climatic Change by Timothy Garrett at the University of Utah that says the only way to prevent runaway greenhouse is complete economic collapse. It might be too late for that, but if we act as if it's too late, that act becomes self-fulfilling prophecy. So let's not act that way.
Hmm. So there are people that I know who have given up their cars. They're riding bicycles. There's also the approach of let's buy our way out of this. We'll buy a bunch of twisty light bulbs. That'll take care of things. When I look at this last, the Durban conference, and I look at Copenhagen and how basically nothing was done by the international community, which I think, in my opinion, I'll just throw my opinion to this. I really want to focus on your opinions, but I'm just going to throw this out here. Maybe you may have a view on this. But it seems as though the world community has really no interest in this, and that if we save fuel by riding bikes instead of cars, it just puts more oil supply into the world market. It's just going to get burned to every last drop anyway.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, William Stanley Jevons wrote about this in 1865 in a book called The Coal Question. It has come to be known as Jevons' Paradox. Efficiency makes the situation worse. As we become more efficient at consuming a finite material, we actually consume more of it. And the other point he makes, the other part of Jevons' paradox, is that if you conserve in a world market, it doesn't matter. Because the United States, for example, hit peak demand for oil in about 2005. But India didn't, and China didn't. And that's what's driving the fluctuations in price of oil now. As the price goes up, it's because of demand from other places. So whereas I encourage people to drop out of industrial civilization to the maximum possible extent, including making a transition towards bicycling and using less energy, because pretty soon we're not going to have access to much anyway, that's no solution to saving habitat for our species and the millions of others with which we co-occupy the planet.
So, Dr. McPherson, I'm talking to Guy McPherson, who's a professor emeritus from the University of Arizona on the subject of environmental science, who left that world so that whenever he's on Skype, there's a rooster in the background. So we've heard the rooster a couple of times. So what is it, Dr. McPherson? There's a leap here. You made a leap from the world of academia into the world of being on a farm. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is you're doing now compared to what you were doing then?
Sure. And let me say that I love that life. I was very good at it. I was an excellent teacher. So good, in fact, that I was asking my students to think, to the extent that I was banned from teaching in my home department. That was the first administrative act of my latest department head. And what I was teaching was that there is a dark underbelly to industrial civilization. You can't teach for many years the dark underbelly of industrial civilization and live at the apex of empire and look at your face in the mirror every day. It just grinds on you after a while. So I had to leave. It wasn't as if I had a choice internally. The choice was I could teach the dark underbelly of industrial civilization and continue to live paradoxically at the apex of empire, or I could continue to look myself in the mirror. So I left. And now I, along with my wife, I share property in southwestern New Mexico with another couple and their 9-year-old son. And we try to produce all of our own food. We have water coming out of the ground with a couple of solar wells, a couple of solar pumps. So we provide our water in that way. We also harvest rainwater off the roofs of the structures on the property. We grow a vast majority of our own food. We have a well-insulated house, and we strive hard to develop and maintain a decent human community in this area. I think those are the four elements we've needed to survive throughout the 2-million-year history of the human experience: water, food, body temperature, and decent human community. And so that's what we work on here.
Mm-hmm. And this is outlined in your most recent book, and this is by Guy McPherson, G.R. McPherson, published in 2011, Walking Away from Empire, A Personal Journey. And it is also available on Amazon and from Barnes & Noble. There are a number of reviews on the book. So how is that? I mean, you've gone beyond, actually. I mean, it's one thing for someone to say, I'm going to go live on a farm, and I'm going to do biodynamic, and please describe what you do there on the farm. And you're going beyond that. You're actually saying, okay, I'm going to get out and help other people do this. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yes. Well, I am a teacher at heart, and I have been frequently described as having a servant's heart. I believe that a life spent in service to the living planet and to other human beings is the only way to live. It's certainly the only way to live for me. So we adhere to the principles of permaculture here in focusing on the things we need to thrive: clean water, healthy food, maintained body temperature, human community. And so we're doing that here. It's a model. I've hosted several hundred people giving little tours on this property over the last few years. I'll be hosting a couple more this afternoon, in fact. And to the extent that I can use this place as a model, I would like to show other people that it's possible, and in fact, even desirable, to live differently than culture has driven us to live. I lived in that way for a very long time. I understand the benefits associated with inexpensive food at your favorite restaurant in the big city. I get all that, but I recognize the consequences as well. And for me, it's important that I try to minimize those consequences by living differently, and hopefully I can continue to teach and show other people how to live differently as well. That's the goal for me.
Are people motivated to do this out of that, for instance, they want to do the right thing, just like riding a bicycle instead of driving a car? Or is there some kind of a moment of realization that people are coming to where they say, first of all, this thing, this industrial civilization can't last anyway. I'm getting off the grid now, because once the grid goes down, I may as well be ready. So is there a certain amount of getting ready that people are motivated to do in addition to certain other motivations? Can you explore that a little bit with us?
Yeah, well, I think fear is a big driver and always has been motivating people. So the fear that industrial civilization might end and leave people high and dry is undoubtedly one of the drivers behind people prepping or preparing for an ambiguous future. And personally, I'm indifferent about the motivations as long as they are underlain by some sense of compassion and creativity for other human beings as well as the living planet. So if fear is what rocks your boat and makes you go back to gardening and growing your own food instead of letting Monsanto grow and poison your food for you, that's fine with me. On the other hand, there's a bunch of people who quickly or gradually realize that there might be a better way to live than just letting ADM, Cargill, and Monsanto produce all of our food for us and deliver it to the grocery store, that there might actually be a more healthy way to live than relying on this industrial culture, which we know has a dark side, or you might say many dark sides.
I'm talking to Dr. Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus from University of Arizona, about getting off the grid, walking away from empire, as the title of his book describes, a personal journey. And something exciting has come along around all this, which is that you are the subject and your community are now the subject of a movie that is in progress, a documentary film that is called, if I understand it correctly, it's Somewhere in New Mexico, Before the End of Time, which is a pretty dramatic title. And I'll tell you, the graphic for that is quite dramatically amazing as well. So it looks like a pretty exciting project, and you'll be out in California this coming weekend, June 1st. Those of you who are getting to our podcast, this will already have happened by the time we're podcast. But I would like to talk about the film and where that's going and how that looks as far as becoming a released project in the near future.
Well, I think it's pretty close. Michael Sowsoby is an independent filmmaker. He's been doing this for a while. I'm very impressed with the footage he has shot so far. He came out to New Mexico for a couple of weeks last fall and followed me around and got introduced to many of my neighbors, many, and probably most of whom, live very differently from the way I lived until just a few years ago, from the way most people in the United States live. As I understand it, we'll be ready for release sometime this fall, with the premiere to be held in Tucson, Arizona, sometime this fall. So it's getting close. I think Mike has a few other people he's going to interview. He's going to take advantage of the event at Oceanside later this week to shoot a little more footage, and he has a few more people to interview as well. But it's pretty close to being ready to go.
And the people that he's been talking to are other people who have been... they kind of come to the same thing, the same kind of conclusions, that this is the time to start walking away from whatever they're doing in working for the empire, as you've termed it, and getting busy with growing food and being off the grid. He's interviewing other people for that as well.
Yes, that's right. He interviewed a couple who were very successful and well-respected teachers in Phoenix, Arizona, Mike and Karen Sleva. They walked away last summer, right about a year ago, and came out here to this property and have since been participating in the WOOFing program, Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. They started here, spent 3 months here, picked up some skills. Now they're in Italy WOOFing. Mike is also interviewing Sherry Ackerman, who is a well-known philosopher who went back to the land in the 70s. Sherry is a colleague of mine. We've worked on several pieces together for the online magazine Transition Voice. And that's at transitionvoice.com if you want to track down some of those conversations right. We've had.
And that's for reaching people in the transition movement or people who are interested in the transition movement, which is all about creating communities off the grid and in anticipation of a failure of the grid or a failure of oil supplies and food supplies. Essentially,
that's right.
Simplifying
it. I speak a lot to transition groups. And in its broadest form, transitioning just means transitioning to a time without fossil fuels in light of global climate change. So how do we do that as communities? Sherry has been working at that for a long time and now lives in Mount Shasta, California. And so there's going to be several people interviewed by Mike for the film, and he interviewed several of my neighbors out here who are making the transition in various forms as well. And there's more than one way. In fact, I would argue there's more than 7 billion ways to make the transition to a life without fossil fuels in light of climate change. But it's time to get cracking on that.
Now, do you think that it's, like you said, there are a number of different ways to make that transition. Does it look to you like, I mean, what would urban people do? It looks like no matter what we do, we need to make sure that there's a food supply. But how does that start to play out with some of the people you've talked to or some examples you've seen, for instance, in urban settings as well as rural settings? Now, you've moved to a place that is rural. Am I correct in that?
Yes, it is quite rural. In fact, there are maybe 50 neighbors within 3 miles of here. So it is quite rural. How do you do this in an urban area? Focus on the big four, which for me is clean water, healthy food, maintaining body temperature, and establishing and maintaining a decent human community. How do you do that in the city? Well, water is huge. So if you can convince the people who make the decisions in the town or the city to maintain the water towers, pump the water up there using solar pumps or some other relatively low technology, and then use gravity to get water flowing through the taps. As near as I can tell, gravity has been working for a long time. Yes. So far, it has yet to fail. And, you know, in every small town and even many large towns in this country, for years and years, there were lots of these water towers because the electrical supply was unreliable. You just didn't have electricity 24/7 like we do now. You had electricity for 20 hours a day, and then it would go out for 3 days. But if you got water up there in that tower and lots of water, you're fine. Mm-hmm. Once you get the water, then making the transition to growing food is really not that difficult. It's not that big a trick. When I started this project just a few years ago, I could barely distinguish between a screwdriver and a zucchini. That tells you everything you need to know about my building skills as well as my growing skills. And so if I can grow food, if I can build these little structures, and pretty much anybody can, there are permaculture groups in probably every urban area in the country, or nearly so at this point. And those are the people to turn to. Those are the people who have been designing, thinking about design and thinking about food production and relocalizing. In terms of maintaining body temperature, that's not hard at all. We all have way too many clothes compared to our relatively recent predecessors. And we also have these nice structures in which we can keep ourselves warm. And then there's developing and maintaining a decent human community. And what I find exciting is that the groups of people who are working on transitioning, that's what brings them together. They have already created a decent human community driven by a profoundly important goal.
And this actually is putting into action that walking away from empire, it sounds like.
Yeah, there's an old expression from the medieval period. It's called walking away from the king. If enough people walk away from the king, king loses all of his power. We're at a point in history now where the governments have become king-like. We are dominated by a central government that most people have come to depend upon, but we need not. What we really need to do is depend upon each other, other human beings, and recognize that we also depend upon a living planet. Let's a whole bunch of us walk away from empire, walk away from the king that is the governmental system for most of the industrialized world at this point. Let's rob them of their power by simply walking away and producing our own water and growing our own food and all of that. It's just not that hard.
And getting your life needs answered by your own community.
Right. In fact, what I call what we're doing here is agrarian anarchy. And most people think that anarchy means chaos. But in fact, anarchy means taking care of yourself, taking responsibility for yourself, and taking responsibility for your neighbors. Here, it means taking responsibility for your neighbors, human and otherwise. One of the major proponents of agrarian anarchy back in the day was Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, currently Wendell Berry, Howard Zinn, recently deceased, Edward Abbey. All of these people were fans of agrarian anarchy. You could argue that Monticello was the perfect initial example of agrarian anarchy developed by Thomas Jefferson. So it's not as if there's no precedence for doing this. It's not as if this is such an absurd way to live that we shouldn't even think about it. It's not that hard. It's fun. It's interesting. You actually get to know your neighbors, human and otherwise, and you get to take care of your daily needs. What could be better than that?
Well, Dr. Guy McPherson, any final words or things that you want to alert us to and our listeners on Shift Shapers?
Well, I want to reinforce that the notion of getting off of the government and getting off of the industry, and they're pretty much the same at this point, removing yourselves from this set of living arrangements most of us have come to depend upon, need not be seen as an impossible task or even an overwhelming task. I can help people do that. I work for free in helping people do that. But people need to start taking responsibility for themselves and for their neighbors and leaving the corporate government behind.
Well, I'm going to end the interview by emphasizing what you just said about working with people for free. So first of all, thank you, Dr. Guy McPherson, for joining us on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio. And I want to tell our listeners and reinforce what you just said, which is that if people will go to the website of Nature Bats Last, How can they find the website? What is it? What is the listing of it? It's guymcpherson.com, isn't it?
That's right. Guymcpherson.com. No A's in McPherson.
Okay, so it's GUYMCPHERSON.com. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And when you look to the part, in fact, I have it up right here, where they're speaking and consulting, where can they find that part about, oh, that's right, it's over on one of your blogs, where you indicate, look, Making Other Arrangements, it's titled, I'd like to help you. So in other words, listeners, this is somebody who is willing and able and is willing to even barter this thing out to get you going off the grid, if that's what you seriously are committed to doing. And that's how I've interpreted what you've said. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I'm willing to help people do whatever it takes to get off of industrial civilization in whatever form. So in whatever way they want to do that, I want to encourage and assist their moves in that direction.
You could have a mass movement getting started right there. Dr. Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus from University of Arizona, very prolific author, definitely prolific blogger. I mean, if you have not been to Guy McPherson's blog, Nature Bats Last, check this thing out. There are guest blogs that are amazing, which I've actually read one of your guest bloggers' work on the air on my radio show. So it's fantastic work. Author most recently, it's called Walking Away from Empire, A Personal Journey. And so that is available through Amazon, through Barnes & Noble, probably a number of other book outlets and local booksellers. And also the subject of a documentary film, which is somewhere in New Mexico before the end of time. So I think we're going to be looking for quite a bit more on the horizon on some of these subjects. And thank you for joining us here on Shift Shapers Pole Reversal Radio, Dr. Guy McPherson.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.